Turn with me to 2 Corinthians chapter 4. And I'm very aware of the fact that you are now at saturation point. But the topic this evening is so important. So important. In fact, I believe that some year tonight, you'll save your life if you just pay attention to what I have to talk about this evening. I want to talk about stress. And I want to get to the nub of it. I'll try not to beat around the bush too much. And do it as painlessly as I possibly can. But it is an extremely important topic. I want to begin by reading 2 Corinthians chapter 4 from verse 7. It's verses 7 to 12 that the Apostle Paul addresses the topic of stress. And I marvel at the Apostle Paul's accurate description of what it is we mean when we talk about stress. He writes, "But we have this treasure in jars of clay." It's another way of saying it, that we have this treasure of the gospel. We minister the gospel out of a body that is very, very vulnerable. "So that this all-surpassing power is from God," to show, "and not from us. We are hard pressed on every side, but not crushed. Perplexed, but not in despair. Persecuted, but not abandoned. Struck down, but not destroyed. We always carry around in our body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be revealed in our body. For we who are alive are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake, so that His life may be revealed in our mortal," or the better translation, "in our dying body. His life is revealed in our dying body. So then, death is at work in us, but life is at work in you." Stress will kill you. No doubt about it. The work of ministry, we don't have an outline for this, so just use a blank page if you want to make some notes. The work of ministry has become increasingly stressful. Going along with, and I think it would be wrong of me to insinuate that only clergy are stressed. Whenever I speak to a mixed audience and I say things like that, I have surgeons come to me, I have air traffic controllers come to me, I have all sorts of people come to me and say, "Hey, my job's stressful too." Yes, along with everybody else's jobs, stress has escalated. But the stress of ministry is particularly different in that it is full of helplessness. Times when you don't feel that you have control. And it also, helplessness is a factor, but also there is a significant factor in stress in the rage that many clergy experience. We won't have time to talk about anger, but clergy are the angriest people I know. I don't know any other category of people who are as angry as clergy. We've done some research in this area. Guess who most clergy are angry at? Who? I'm sorry, I'm missing that. The deacons. Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, deacons. That there are two that vie for the top post. The congregation and the spouse. Congregation and spouse vie for first place. Depends which denomination you're in. Spouse and congregation, top of the list. Angry at. Third, oneself. A lot of anger directed at himself. And anger is stressful, I can tell you that right now. And these two things, helplessness and rage, hostility, anger, these are the two things that do the most destruction in our bodies. But back up just a moment, I want to tell you how serious is the stress problem. 1 out of 4 adults in the United States has high blood pressure. 1 out of 4. Has what is known as essential hypertension. This is not blood pressure that's due to bad kidneys or anything else. This is blood pressure due to the fact that they are under stress. 1 million Americans die every year of heart disease. And the majority of them die from a form of heart disease that is produced by stress. 1 million. That's 1 out of every 240 Americans drop dead every year from a heart attack. It's a stress problem. We don't know how many millions suffer from ulcers. That's a stress problem. Panic anxiety disorder. Now the number one mental health problem in the United States. Panic anxiety disorder. It's a stress problem. It hits mainly people in the age range from 35 to about 40, maybe 41, 42. That age range is now. They're going down like pinballs. Do you have pinballs here in bowling? They're dropping like pinballs. My own son-in-law, the husband of my eldest daughter, who is a high-pressured business person, former pastor, burnt out in ministry, then goes into business, works twice as hard, but doesn't burn out because he makes 4 times as much money. It's amazing, you know, what money can do, what you can put up with. If you can get paid enough for it, you can put up with an awful lot. But we were in Hawaii about 5 weeks ago. Well, no, we've been here 6 weeks, 7 weeks. So that, I'm talking 9 weeks ago now. We just arrived on the Friday to do a conference, and my oldest daughter telephoned from home, from Los Angeles, from Pasadena. And she was in a terrible state. She said, "Dad, I don't know where Rick is. I don't know where Rick is. This is Richard's thing all over again," she says. I feel like I'm having... There's a famous old-time baseball player used to say, "It's deja vu all over again." Catherine was saying, "It's like deja vu, Richard." The day Richard was killed, his accident was midday. We didn't find him until 10 o'clock at night. She said, "I don't know where Richard is." I said, "Honey, what's the problem?" She said, it's Friday afternoon, about 1 o'clock in Los Angeles. And she says, "I get a telephone call from Rick. He's out on some business calls. And he says, 'I'm calling from a phone booth because I'm having very severe chest pains. I feel like I'm having a heart attack.'" He's only 37. "Feel like I'm having a heart attack. I've got to get to the emergency room right away. I'll call you later," and hangs up. Now it's 3 hours later. She hasn't heard from him. Can you imagine what a frightening thing that is? But he happened to mention that he pulled into a filling station, petrol station. So yeah, she's sitting, doesn't know where he is. So she thinks, "Well, maybe I'll just start calling petrol stations around Los Angeles." Do you know how many thousands there are? Start at A. ABC petrol filling station. Gas station. Calls. Was there a man there using a telephone who looked like he was in distress? No. And about 4 hours afterwards, he finally telephones. He checked into an emergency room, a hospital. So they run all the tests, and the doctor says, "I'm not having a heart attack." He says, "I'm having a panic anxiety attack." But that can't be true. This can't be happening to me. I'm too strong. I'm Superman. And the panic anxiety attack hits people 35 to 40 who are super people. But they are the ones who are living on the edge, you see. Those are the ones who are pushing themselves. That's a stress problem. Sleep disorders. Any idea how much difficulty people have falling asleep? They toss and they turn, can't get to sleep. When they get to sleep, they sleep 3 hours. And then they're wide awake again. That's a stress problem. I want to say something about sleep tonight. You're not going to get away without my little spiel, my speech on sleep. Headaches. Tons and tons and tons of painkillers sold across the counter all around us, the world, to help people with headaches. Depression. quite a lot of depression is stress-triggered. Stress-triggered. And on and on. I mean, we can just go on and on and on, painting a picture of the impact that stress is having on our world today. But what is stress? Stress is four things. First of all, stress is... Can you see that? That looks light to me. Stress is disease. It is a disease. In and of itself, it constitutes a disease, but it also is the cause of a lot of diseases. One of the consequences of chronic stress, stress that is there for a long period of time, is that the immune system becomes compromised. So your body can't fight disease anymore. So we have to dispense large quantities of antibiotics. Because people's immune systems are not functioning anymore. One of the most serious disorders of our day is known as acquired immune deficiency syndrome. It's a deficiency disorder. Because our immune systems are the only systems available to fight viral disorders. We have no medication for viruses. We had a conference at Fuller 4 years ago. We have a research lab that looks at psychoneuroimmunology, the impact that psychological factors has on our immune system. And we invited some of the prominent researchers from around the country to present at this conference. And one after another of these experts said, AIDS is only the tip of the iceberg. Only the tip of the iceberg. We haven't seen anything yet. In terms of what they see is happening, coming down the pike to us, because the more our immune systems become compromised, the more viral illnesses are going to emerge. It's a serious matter. You heard something about the Ebola outbreak, and there's a little fear now that it may have actually got to the States. I mean, that's a horrible thing. You get it one day, and a week later, you're dead. And that's the sort of thing that they're hinting at, because our immune systems are compromised because we are overstressed. So it's a disease. Secondly, stress is also excitement. And this is perhaps the most interesting one and the most difficult one to get people to understand. Stress is excitement. I have a chain of elastic bands at the back. You may not be able to see it very well, but that's your fault for sitting at the back. It's a different colored elastic bands. I'll describe it for you so that you can, in your imagination, see it. Red, yellow, blue, white, yellow, blue, green, red, blue. And they are linked together in a chain like that. Each one of them represents a different part of our body system. You know, one is the brain, and the other is the respiratory system, and there's the gastrointestinal system, and our cardiovascular system, and so on and so on down. Now, the thing about stress to understand is that stress is arousal. And the essence of the stress response is arousal of our adrenaline. That's what it is, you know. It's adrenaline. That's what stress is all about. Stress, adrenaline goes up. Now imagine, you wake up in the morning, your system is nice and relaxed, you open your eyes and boing, you're awake. Your adrenaline is triggered, it's kicked in. Now, as the day progresses, the system is constantly being alerted and relaxing, and alerted, aroused, and alert. Now the thing about this chain, the reason why it's very helpful to understand is that we don't arouse just one little bit of our body, see? That when arousal takes place, all the systems are aroused. And this is this constant vigilance we call the fight or flight response. The fight or flight response. Adrenaline alerting us and then saying, no, not an emergency, and it goes down. Because it is essentially an emergency response system. And so constantly it's alerting us, emergency, the phone rings, emergency. No, it's okay, it's only the telephone. And so it's constantly doing this. After a while, what happens, you see, is that it gets more and more aroused. You see it? Now, if you look very carefully, those of you who are close by, you'll see that one of these systems, one of these elastic bands, is stretching more than the others. Can you see it? The yellow one. Right there. And if I keep doing this now, what happens is, because it's going to happen in a minute, That one's going to snap. And I wanted to, because I want to show you what happens when it snaps. But but you see, constantly. Now, what's happened is that what is healthy, get this point, what is healthy, doesn't matter how much you stretch the system. Provided on a regular basis, it goes back to that. Because during this period of non-arousal is when the rejuvenation, the repair, the restoration takes place, you see? So the Apostle Paul says, renewed day by day. That's a smart man. He knows what he's talking about. Because that's got to happen. And the provision for this is our nighttime rest. But what has happened is that we instead of living from this to that to this to that, our systems have adapted to a lifestyle of emergency living. An emergency lifestyle. So we are now going from that to this, to that to this, to that to this. Instead of from that to this, it's from this to this. So we get to bed at night and we're not relaxed. And we barely can fall asleep. And even when we're asleep, we grind our teeth because our muscles are tense, bruxism. And we grind our teeth away. And so we're living out on the edge like this, so our adrenal systems are constantly aroused. And when a real emergency comes, we don't have any reserves left now. You see, because we're living on the edge. And stress is living like this. It's accelerated wear and tear. It's accelerated dying. Now, if I keep doing this, this one that is beginning to stress, it's giving up its elasticity. It's not bouncing back. It's not elastic enough anymore. And if you examine it closely, little fine hair cracks are beginning to develop. And sooner or later, if I keep doing this here, this yellow one, it's going to be the yellow one, it's going to snap. And that yellow snap represents the weak link in the chain. And every one of us has a weak link in our chain. We have a system that's going to show our stress. For some of us, it's going to be ulcers. For some of us, it's going to be headaches. For some of us, it's going to be ulcers and headaches. but the important point is that we all show the signs of stress in different parts of our system. That's part of a system that has the most serious consequences for stress is the cardiovascular system, the heart. Because heart disease is the most serious consequence. It kills you, literally kills you. Now, I say that the stress is excitement because it's adrenally driven, because it depends on adrenaline. And stress is arousal of the adrenal system, over-arousal of the adrenal system. That's what stress is all about. The problem here is that adrenaline is also a powerful drug that has a direct pathway to a center in the brain that is called the pleasure center. Now, you can actually do this. It's never been done on humans because no one's volunteered their brain for this experiment. But it's done on animals all the time. You take a pair of electrodes and you implant them into the center, into the pleasure center, pair of electrodes, and you take little thin wires out to an external stimulator, and the cat, often it's a cat, has this little blob thing on its head, on its skull, a little plastic thing, housing the wires going in, and the cat is roaming around, and every time you press the button on the electric stimulator, the cat has a surge of pleasure. Or what, better still, set up a switch. So every time the cat wants a pleasure, just press the switch. I know some people who'd like one of those machines. Just press the switch. That cat will turn away from food, press that button. No sex, no food. Will starve or dehydrate to death. We'll press that button. Now, the thing about the pleasure center is never satiates. You never, stomach satiates, appetite satiates. It gets full. But the pleasure center doesn't. And the pleasure center, there's a lot of things we do that send signals to the pleasure center. Sex is one of them. Eating is another one. But adrenaline has a direct connection to the pleasure center, because this is part of God's intelligent creation. If I were to design the body for fight or flight, to defend itself in an emergency, you either have to fight to protect yourself or run to protect yourself. One of the things I would do, and this is exactly what God did, is connect the adrenaline that you need to fight to the pleasure center, because you don't want to make it unpleasant. If you make it unpleasant, then you're not going to fight and you're not going to flee. And that's why adrenaline is the most powerful drug today. Because it's from within our own bodies. And we become excitement addicts. Workaholism. There are some forms of workaholism, of course, that have to do with distorted beliefs and so on, but most of it is an adrenaline addiction. It's an adrenaline. There's a literal addiction to adrenaline, because the adrenaline can trigger the pleasure center. And it's the same pathway, listen to this, it's the same pathway that is used by cocaine. And so I wrote a book, Healing Life's Hidden Addictions. I deal with the non-substance addictions. And one of the points I try to make in that book is that anything that triggers adrenaline is just as powerfully addicting as cocaine or any of those others. And so what you get these idiots who connect themselves to an elastic umbilical cord, right? And then stand on the edge of a bridge or something. And I think you invented it in this country, didn't you? New Zealanders. Oh, okay. New Zealand. Then, and you jump off, you know, and you go boing, boing. And when they come off the bridge, what do they say? An adrenaline surge, you see. Adrenaline rush. And so we look for adrenaline. So the problem is, stress is excitement. Now, most people, when they think of stress, think of that stress is that which makes life miserable. Catastrophe. Tension. And those things are stressful. But they don't kill us, because the unpleasant triggers of stress, we take steps to avoid. The one category of adrenaline excitement that we do not take steps to avoid is the stuff that excites us. A challenge. Exciting challenge. Projects. There are some people who are addicted to starting new things. In my, just 2 weeks ago in Sydney, when I was teaching there, a Korean student from Los Angeles, he was sharing with me, in fact, he was showing off to me, all the projects he has started. He's only 36, and he's got 20 things he's started. I asked him, have you finished any of them? No, he says, it's my weakness, he said, I like starting things, I just don't like finishing them. And gradually he became to realize that this was an adrenaline thing for him, you see, because it gets adrenaline excitement going. Now, it's excitement. It's excitement that stress is all about. It's not the catastrophes of life. It's the exciting things of life, because that is what kills us, because we don't pay attention to it. It jacks up the adrenaline, and we're turning up the high octane. And in a moment, I'll explain what this high adrenaline does to us. And then, of course, it is the third thing is, and I've already alluded to this, that stress is addiction. And that's what makes it so dangerous. This is why it eludes people. I sit with patients all the time, referred to me by their cardiologist, saying, we've done open heart surgery, I've done the Roto-Rooter job on them. You know, that's when they put in that Roto-Rooter thing and sort of scrape out all the growth inside the muscles, veins and arteries. And I can't do anything more. We've got to do something. And they come and they sit down and they say to me, no, I am not stressed. I can't be stressed. I enjoy life too much. How on earth can it be stressed? And he doesn't show for his appointment next week. And I think, classic, you know. Classic. So I leave it a day or two, he doesn't call. So I think, I'm going to call his wife and find out, make sure everything's okay. And I call her up and she says, oh, shucks, I'm sorry, I should have called and told you. Bill dropped dead of a heart attack last Friday. You know, here's a man claiming that he is not under stress. And he drops dead on me. And it's happened several times. Because it's addicting. Now, how can you tell if you're addicted to adrenaline? You can't tolerate boredom. You don't know how to relax. When you do relax, you feel guilty. When you do relax, you get that fidgety feeling. I remember some years ago when we first went to Hawaii, I was going to teach there for 2 weeks. And first time we'd gone to Hawaii, and I was really stressed. I'd been pushing myself hard. And I said to Kath, let's go a week ahead and just vacation for a week. And the first morning we got to Hawaii, right? I got up bright and early in the morning. An adrenaline addict cannot enjoy a vacation. Yeah, I kept thinking, I've got to do something. So I stand at the window and I look out at the window, beautiful ocean. And I walk over and I sit down and I turn the television set on. Set warms up, but no sooner warms up, and I turn it off. Because you can't concentrate. Pick up a book, and I read a paragraph, and I haven't paid attention to anything. I put the book down, turn on the television set again, it warms up, turn it off, don't stand at the window, pace up and down, I'm restless. Cat's still in bed, I'm wanting her to get up. Come on, honey, get up, let's go. Let's go do something. Let's go do something. We're on holiday, got to do something. She's lying there fast asleep still. Because it's 5 o'clock in the morning. So I think I've got to take a walk. I walk down the 7 flights of stairs to the bottom. I'm going to stand and look in the shop windows, you know. There's hardly anyone else around. Take the elevator back upstairs to the room. You didn't expect you to walk up 7 flights of stairs, did you? Sit down, turn on the television set, wait for it to warm up, turn it off, pick up the book, put it down, pace up and down. And Kat tells me that literally for 4 days, she watched me go through the withdrawal symptoms of a powerful drug. Irritable. And then slowly, about the 5th day, a sense of peacefulness and quietness came over me. And I could sit still. You see, adrenaline addict needs stimulation. You get in the car, first thing you do is turn the radio on. Can't tolerate silence. And if there isn't enough stimulation around, you pick a fight. I mean, that'll do it for you. Just pick a fight. Just gets your adrenaline going. Adrenaline is an addiction. Now, add to that, what is the most powerful adrenaline stimulant we have? Caffeine. Not sex. Keith, you got it wrong. Not sex. Caffeine. And why do you think caffeine is addicting? Because it stimulates adrenaline. 4 cups of coffee will quadruple your adrenaline. Tea is 1/4 of the caffeine of coffee. And that's a little better. Better still, drink decaffeinated coffee. I'll come back to that a little later. So it's addiction. The fourth thing that stress is dead. You see, it's dead. No, seriously, the fourth one is disobedience. I honestly do believe this. I don't say it lightly. I believe that stress is disobedience. And I can say that out of my own personal experience. 20 years ago, I was about the most stressed out person you can imagine. High blood pressure, I needed to take medication for it. Tried to renew my pilot license. The physician said, no, sorry, your blood pressure is too high. Let's get it down first before we can talk about that. And it suddenly dawned on me that I was killing myself. But it was a spiritual issue for me. It became a spiritual issue because it's disobedience. God spoke to me and said, my child, you know, you are so much in a hurry, so stressed that I can't even talk to you. And many of us are just running too fast for God. And so it's disobedience. It's a sign that we don't have our theology straight. A lot of us are under stress because we try to prove something to ourselves or to somebody else or someone in our grandparents. And so I want to emphasize that, and stress management is a spiritual discipline, is the obvious implication of that. So the essence of the stress response is adrenaline goes up. Now what is the effect of that? What's so bad about having all that circulating adrenaline? Let me just tell you what is bad about it. The first thing that higher levels of adrenaline do for us is that it raises our cholesterol level. There's been a study going on in Framingham, Massachusetts, a little town in near Boston, where the whole town is part of an extensive study been going on for 25 years onto the causes and cures of early heart disease. It's called the Framingham Heart Study. That study has demonstrated that the most you can benefit in terms of lowering your cholesterol through diet is about 13%. The rest of the cholesterol comes from the liver in response to the adrenaline signal, emergency. Cholesterol, you see, is an essential ingredient in an emergency. It's the lubricant for our joints, for example. Cholesterol is, in an emergency, is the very substance you need. But if you're living an emergency lifestyle, cholesterol goes up and you don't need it. So where does it go? It gathers up all those fats and before you know it, the arteries are starting to get blocked, particularly around the heart. In a series of autopsies done in the late 30s, a long time ago, on 3,000 consecutive men who died of heart disease, in this particular study, serial autopsies on heart disease, men who died of heart disease, showed that in every instance their adrenal glands were enlarged. That elevated adrenaline is the primary cause of a lot of there are some congenital forms, but the typical stress-related cardiovascular disease. Adrenaline goes up, your blood pressure goes up. If your blood pressure is up, just have your adrenaline circulating monitored, you'll see that that's up. Not only adrenaline goes up, but some research done in Australia shows that another hormone produced by the adrenal glands, cortisol, goes up. And cortisol is the critical factor in the panic anxiety disorder. So we see a very clear connection here. Our problem is that stress is bad. It's bad. We are not designed. We were designed for... And most of us are trying to behave like supersonic jets. And therein lies the problem. Elevated adrenaline also increases the clotting capacity of the blood. It's intelligent creation. Fight or flight. Imagine designing the body for fight or flight. And you're going to use your hands to fight and your feet to flee, right? In primitive times, the way we were created, you know, shoes, bare feet. So you're going to fight and run bare feet. The chances of cutting yourself in the feet and hands very high in an emergency. So the body protects itself. It does two things. First of all, it withdraws, during an emergency, when your adrenaline goes up, the blood is withdrawn from your hands and from your feet. And the sign of that is your hands get cold. So pastor, when you step out of the pulpit on a Sunday morning after you've preached, what do people say when they shake your hands? Why, pastor, your hands are so cold. That's an adrenaline response. And the blood is withdrawn because if you cut yourself, the chances of bleeding to death are minimized. But the second thing it does, it doesn't only pull the blood back, it's called peripheral vasoconstriction, but it also raises the clotting capacity of the blood. So the blood clots more quickly. I don't know if we have any dentists here, but dentists, when they're going to extract a tooth, will ask you, are you allergic to adrenaline? No. That's good, because I'm going to give you Novocaine with adrenaline. Why? Because the adrenaline stops, it clots the blood. You won't bleed. And so you get a shot of Novocaine with adrenaline, and the adrenaline shuts down the blood vessel so you don't bleed so much. It's intentional, it's purposeful. This is nothing random. But when you live an emergency lifestyle, it goes wrong because now your blood clots too easily. Now, when the artery gets smaller and smaller and smaller from the circulating cholesterol and the fats, it gets to a point where it's small enough now that all it takes is one adrenaline surge, a panic, a moment of stress. The clotting capacity of the blood goes up, and the next surge of blood through that narrowed artery blocks the artery, shuts off the blood to a critical part of the heart. And that's what a heart attack is all about. So, let me tell you now, this is hot off the press from the United States. We're being told now in the courses I've been taking, the researchers are saying that one of the best ways to protect yourself if you're having a heart attack is to carry with you an aspirin at all times. Have a little pill box or something. Always, if you're at the age when you're at high risk, carry an aspirin with you and immediately take that aspirin. Because aspirin, as you probably know, is a blood thinner. And it's some evidence to show that in that critical hour, that 1 hour from the moment you have the heart attack to when you've got to get help, that within that 1 hour, just chewing an aspirin can make the difference between life and death for you. And of course, you also probably know that to take a half an aspirin or a baby aspirin every day, if you're in the high risk range, don't take it if you're not in the high risk range, because if you take too much aspirin, then you can bleed to death. You have an ulcer and you'll bleed to death. But that a low dose of aspirin can help to thin the blood. Now, that's treating the symptom. That's not treating the disease. The disease is your adrenaline is too high. So let's get back to talking about what you do about the disease and not what you do about the symptom. So let me share with you some thoughts then about managing your adrenaline. Because that's my book, Adrenaline and Stress. That's the theme of the book. Manage your adrenaline. Don't let adrenaline control you. You control your adrenaline. 1 Thessalonians 4 verse 4. Let every one of you learn to control your body. I control my adrenaline. My adrenaline doesn't control me. Now, the first thing you have to do in managing your adrenaline is to determine whether or not you are a type A personality or not. Gath made mention of it, and most of you probably know about the type A personality. There are basically two types of personality. When it comes to heart disease, there are two types of personalities, type A and type B. Those who can't make up their minds are called type X. But you're either type A or type B. Now, I'm a classic type A personality. Let me tell you the characteristics. Now, you've got to know this, because the type A person pumps 4 times more adrenaline than type B, and the type A person is 4 times greater risk of developing heart disease than type B. So it's a very, very important risk factor. Type A person, always in a hurry, very time conscious. I'm never late for an appointment. My patients will tell you, I am always on time. Very time conscious. It's sometimes called hurry sickness. Type A, always in a hurry. A type A is impatient when delayed. Hates standing in queues. Because and impatience drives your adrenaline up. Being hurried drives your adrenaline up. Type A people have they finish your sentences for you. You know, they're around the block in their thoughts, and you're still struggling a bit back here, you know. Come on. My wife will often tell you, now, type A's always marry type B's, and a type B person is slow, sluggish, easygoing. Type A, quick to anger. Type B, slow to anger. Type A, impatient. Type B, very patient. Type A, always on time. In fact, I'm always early for fear that I might be late. Type B's, they think that being early is coming half an hour late. Type A's, usually dressed and standing at the door waiting, and their car keys, you see them, they stand like this, and they throw their car keys up and down. You know, it's that impatient, throwing their car keys, hoping that you will hear it. They also tap their foot a lot. Or they kick their leg a lot. Type A people, type B the exact opposite. Type A's always marry type B's. Type A people have a deep sense of justice. Well, be type anybody who doesn't keep the rules. Some of you have heard the story, but I'm going to tell it anyway. A cat will often, late at night, 9 o'clock at night, say to me, "Honey, I need some bread, I need some salt, I need sugar." Anything she can think of. Invent. To get me to get on my bicycle and ride 2 miles down to the nearest supermarket. And I play along. And I get on my bicycle and go to the supermarket. Now, supermarkets are designed for type A's and type B's. The type A's, they have the express line designed to get you out of there as fast as you can, see? A little red basket, 10 items or less, cash only. I think it's 8 items here, isn't it? You grab your little red basket, you go, I'm going to get my 2 or 3 items, and I come out and I stand in the express line. It's usually busy that time of the night, and tap my foot. And then I count the number of items in everybody else's basket. And woe betide anybody who's got more than 10 items. I get so livid, I get so mad. Why doesn't the checkout clerk do something? Now, you just stand there. You don't do anything. You just get livid. Another thing I've noticed, that supermarket managers know the difference between type A's and type B's. They do. They take the type B checkout clerks and put them on the express line. Deliberately. To frustrate our type A's who are trying to get out of that place as fast as we possibly can. And then you look at the other lines, they got all the type A clerks. And they come with these big baskets and they just zip them through. And you're standing there with a little basket. And then you look down at that person's basket. And then you struggle and you think, is a 6-pack one item? Just before we came, this is true, just before we came to Australia, I was in the 9 o'clock at night doing my little shopping, and there was this lady in front of me, and she had 12 bottles of wine, obviously going to give a party of some sort, you know, and I couldn't contain myself. I said, "Lady, ma'am, don't you read the sign, 10 items?" She looked at her wine, she looked at the sign, and says, "But they're all the same sort of thing, so it doesn't count." Now, of course, there are many times I've sneaked through with 12 items. But you see, that's the thing about being a type A. Everybody else must keep the rules, not you. Now, you've got to know if you're a type A. Because you see, I go home from one of those visits to the supermarket, and my adrenaline is pumping like mad. Emergency, emergency. Now I try to lie down and go to sleep, and I can't go to sleep. I'm fighting with the person with 12 bottles of wine. The point I'm leading up to is this. You've got to change your type A characteristics. I often get asked, "Well, if I'm a type A, can I change and become a type B?" No, you can't. Now, I don't know why you would want to. I'm gonna hammer the type B's tomorrow, by the way. I'll just give you a notice. I'm talking stress. Tomorrow I'm talking burnout. Type A's are prone to stress. Type B's are prone to burnout. But no, you can't change your personality. But you can learn to behave like a type B. So what I do is, when I'm walking around campus, type A's always do more than one thing at the same time. Type A's gotta carry a book. They can never go to the toilet just to go to the toilet. Got to read something. Got to do something. Got to knit. Got to crochet. Got to write books. You know, toilet time mustn't be wasted time. Around campus, you know, I used to always see me, not one book, 2 books, you know. Now you've got to behave like a type B. Now I don't take anything. Do one thing at a time. Your goal is to lower your adrenaline. Get your adrenaline down. So type A's think on multiple tracks. You've got this thought, you know, your mind is overloaded because it's got this and that and that and this and then back again. And seen those people who spin plates on top of long poles? It's a circus act. And they keep 12 of these things going at one time. That's type A person in their thinking. Got to right, keep that one going. Keep that one going. Oh, it's going to fall. Keep this one going. And you overstimulate your mind, and that overstimulates your adrenaline, you see. You've got, the goal is to lower your adrenaline. Adrenaline is for emergency. Ask yourself, is this an emergency? Then learn to relax. My book, Adrenaline and Stress, has a whole bunch of strategies, so I don't feel the need to share all of this with you. You wouldn't buy the book if I did. But I do want to say, you've got to avoid frustration. And, you know, and this is a very, very important one, because you've got to learn to avoid frustration. You know, the best way to avoid frustration is to choose your own delays. Let me tell you the story. It's the supermarket. It's type A, type B checkout clerk. Foot tapping. Count number of items in basket. Get mad because three people ahead of me have got 11 items instead of 10. Look across at the other lines. They're moving rapidly. I feel my adrenaline going up. I feel my blood pressure going up. My wristwatch is a blood pressure monitor, by the way. I monitor my blood pressure all the time. I feel my blood pressure going up. I check my watch. Yeah, blood pressure is up. I say to myself, you're killing yourself. Now, come on, what are you going to do about it? This is some years ago, 9 or 10 years ago. I finally decide this is a spiritual issue. So I take my little red basket and I went and stood in the longest line in the supermarket. I'm say to myself, now I am choosing my delay. And you know, the moment I did that, a peace came over me. Pray to God, God, just teach me to slow down. Teach me to slow down. The lady on the express line is now free. I'm in the long line. She looks over at me. She beckons. I stand there and I stare at her and I say, no. And a little old lady standing in front of me, a big basket, turns around to look at me, looks down at my little red basket, 3 items. Back at me again. I can read her mind. This guy's really a kook, you know that? And I say, good evening, ma'am. How are you this evening? She's taken aback. Oh, she says, not so good this evening. I said, what's the problem? Share it with me. Oh, she says, I have a 16-year-old grandson and he was arrested today for drug possession. I'm not feeling so good tonight. I said, I'm sorry to hear that. But, tell me about your grandson. And she starts to share and she starts to unburden herself. Slowly the line moves forward. And the next thing I wake up, come to my senses. She is already through, checked all her items and paid. And she's pushing her basket and she turns to look at me and she says these words, thank you for talking to me. I have no one else I can share this with. And she's gone. And I'm standing there, I'm saying, wait, you can't go yet. I'm not finished with you. I want to scream at her and say, come back! We're not done yet! And you know, suddenly the sense of shame came over me. I realized how often I had rushed out of that supermarket. Because I don't know why. I'm not going anywhere. The sense of, got to get out. And was this the Lord confirmed to me that night? You know, if you just slow down a little bit, maybe I can use you. So now when I go to the supermarket, I get my items, I go and stand in the longest line. Talk to the person in front. Not always someone who needs anything, but often. Often someone just needing a word of encouragement, a little direction. One lady one night had a little son with her, and the whole side of his one head was, all the hair had been pulled out. It's a fairly common stress disorder in children. I recognized it. Started talking to her. And she happened to mention, she said, what do you do? I said, I'm a psychologist. She said, my son's got a real stress problem. Look at his hair. He keeps pulling it out with his fingers. So I was able to give her some advice, give her some direction, told her where she could go and get some help for that. I come out of the supermarket, I said, you know, almost every time I slow down, God uses me. The only time He uses me is when I slow down. I was speaking at a large woman's gathering, and it was a four-square gathering of women, 800 women. A large gathering of women. not a gathering of large women. Okay, I'll start again. A large gathering of women of the four square denomination. And they'd asked me to speak about stress. They wanted to understand their husbands better. And I was telling the story about the supermarket. And how I'm standing in the long line, and this lady on the counter calls me over. Often I shake my head. And then I look down below the pulpit, just two rows back on the left. There's that lady staring up at me with eyes wide open. She came up afterwards and said, you know, I've always seen you do that. I thought you were a little strange up here. But now I understand why. It was that, you know, and you've got to slow down. Plan ahead for high demand. You know, we get into periods, we know ahead of time, this is going to be a period of intense, stressful demand. Plan ahead. But time is going, and I want to just say a few things about sleep. Because, quite frankly, I have come to the conclusion that no matter how stressed you are, if on a daily basis you get sufficient sleep for your body's needs, you can restore all the damage that stress has done for the day. Of that I am convinced. The $64,000 question. How much sleep do we need to rejuvenate our bodies? 3 years ago, when Bill Clinton became President of the United States, one of the first things he did was to appoint a commission on sleep to report to Congress on the state of the union, on the state of the union with regard to sleep. Real serious concern that we have become an underslept society, and we're seeing the consequences of this in accidents, industrial accidents, motor car accidents, and on and on and on. Enormous cost to the nation. This commission on sleep, all these sleep experts in the United States get together for months, prepare this report, and they send the report to the President of the United States, who, by the way, admitted that he only sleeps about 5 or 6 hours a night. The recommendation of that commission on sleep was that the minimum amount of sleep that an adult needs to function healthily and normally is 8.5 hours a night. Now, that's a half an hour less than I recommended in my book, Adrenaline and Stress, which was written long before the commission on sleep. And there's a reason why I say 9 hours, or 8.5 is close enough. and there's a reason for that, and just in closing, I can say it quickly, I hope. The reason for that is that when we sleep in 90-minute intervals. So this is, we lay down, we go to sleep. We sleep in 90-minute intervals. Not all of this is unconscious. You don't have to be unconscious to be sleeping. If you wake up in the early hours of the morning, rest. Just lie there. Do nothing. And you're sleeping. But we sleep in 90-minute intervals. We need about 90 minutes, first 1.5 hours. At the end of that period, we go into a dream sleep. Dream sleep is only the last few minutes of that cycle, and then we wake up. And so sleep is broken into two components. Non-dream sleep, which you can be just resting and awake. and dream sleep, which is the deepest stage of sleep. And then we wake up and we repeat the cycle again. This is when you toss in the bed. This is when you turn over. But most of us are still tired, so we fall asleep immediately and we repeat the cycle. For many people, they do three of these cycles, which is 4.5 hours. And then when they wake up, their adrenaline kicks in because the adrenaline is saying, go, let's go. And then they're wide awake. And then if you get up and go and make yourself a cup of tea, read a book, then your adrenaline really comes awake. Now you can't get back to sleep again. Now as each dream cycle goes through, it gets longer. It starts about 3 minutes. And at the last dream cycle, before you wake up, which is about the 9th hour, the dream stage could be as long as 20 minutes. So to get enough dream sleep, you have to sleep longer. Most of the dream sleep comes towards the tail end. Now, your options are this. You must have a complete cycle. To sleep, you must have a complete cycle. 1.5 hours. So what are our options? 1.5. 3. 4.5. 6. 7.5. 9. 10.5. 12. And many type B people actually sleep in this range here. Type B people, because their adrenaline is lower, sleep longer. And as a consequence, they have healthier lives because of it. But 8.5 doesn't quite fit, you see. Because I contend you must get a dream cycle in. And this is the most important thing I can say to you about sleep. That the function of non-dream sleep is mainly physical. Physical rejuvenation. But most of us don't do enough physical work to warrant 9 hours of sleep. Which is why we have invented exercise. So if you're not exercised, you don't get enough physical fatigue to warrant 9 hours of sleep. But you need 9 hours of sleep, not for the non-dream sleep, but for the dream stage of sleep. It's the dream stage of sleep that is mainly psychological in rejuvenation. It's during dream sleep that we consolidate our memory. During dream sleep, a thing happens in the brain called garbage collection, where it gathers up all the unresolved issues and unfinished bits and pieces and tries to get closure so as to clear the mind for the next day. It's the same thing that happens to big computers in banks. Someone's got to go in the middle of the night and run a program called the garbage collector that consolidates all the memory and clears all the workspace out. Now, if you fail to get enough dream sleep, you have what is called fuzzy logic. You can't reason clearly. You feel like you're in a cloud. You have headaches. You make mistakes. You do something. You write something and it doesn't come out right. So you've got to go back and do it again. The brain's efficiency dramatically declines the less dream sleep you have. But the trouble is, to get enough dream sleep, you've got to sleep longer, because the largest percentage of dream sleep comes later in the dream cycle, in the sleep cycle. But you don't have enough physical tiredness to get you that long. So you see why we have sleep problems. And this is why physical exercise is so crucial. Not just because the body needs it, because your sleep cycle needs it. And the lower you can get your adrenaline, the more you work at lowering that adrenaline, the better and longer your sleep is. So increased sleep is a sign that your adrenaline is coming down. It's also helpful in lowering the stress that causes the adrenaline. It has a synergistic effect. That's my speech. We have a few minutes for comments or questions, and I'd be happy to take them. Because we're not going anywhere, so. Thank you. Yes, thank you. Excellent, excellent. Anything you can do to externalize what's going on in your mind helps the brain. This knows. The brain knows you have externalized it. To use computer language, you write it to the disk. See? And if you keep having something that you have to remember the next day,
You'll notice that your brain will keep reminding you of it. And all night you lie there, the brain wakes you up and reminds you of it. Write it down, the brain knows you've got it externalized and lets it go. Journaling. Also talking things out. Resolve your anger before the sun sets, the Apostle Paul says. Why? It's the only way you're going to get your adrenaline down before you go to sleep. Good point. Yes. Oh, it's helpful. But it's not helpful for the dream stuff. It's helpful for the physical stuff. So a half hour lie down helps to relax your adrenal system. That's the real value of it. It lowers your adrenaline, gets it down to a lower level, so you pick up again, and you've conserved some adrenaline. And it's very, very helpful. But if you can possibly do it, take a 1.5 hour siesta and end with a dream. The other thing I should say is, don't let an alarm clock wake you up during a dream cycle. Or put it another way, throw the alarm clock away. Because the next time your alarm clock wakes you during a dream, notice how horrible the rest of the day is. Just notice it. I put an alarm as backup. But if I need an alarm to wake me up, it's a sign I'm not getting enough sleep. I must go to bed earlier. Because if an alarm clock has to wake you, your body needs more sleep. Because if you're getting enough sleep, you will wake up naturally. Yes. To unwind. Yeah. Well, there are several things. People who are physically tired just lie down and they light up, which is the value of physical exertion. Often wives, hard, heavy day. Wives have much more stressful lives than men, women do. Well, that I'm convinced. And often, you know, my one daughter would say, I'm so tired, and I just lie down, I'm lying down. See, physical fatigue facilitates the onset of it. And it's when you've got all this mental activity going and not enough physical activity, then your mind won't let, the mind doesn't unwind. It's not tired yet, because your body is not tired enough to do that. But there's another explanation also, and that's that sleep onset is a habit. That's why you must always go to bed at the same time every night. Do not vary the time you go to bed. Because sleep onset, there's a body clock that is set. Melatonin is a hormone produced in the brain with the onset of darkness. Another important principle is that until we turn off the lights, melatonin does not start to be produced. So most of us leave the lights on bright until we want to go to bed. I wonder why we can't get to sleep, because it's going to take an hour and a half, or maybe 2 hours for melatonin to be produced. And melatonin has to be produced in order for sleep to sit in. So what Kath and I do, early evening, we lower the lights in our home. We have just little wall lights. Lower the lights as much as we can. And that produces a slow onset of drowsiness, and so you can fall asleep more naturally. Yes. Mothering stage, that's the most difficult stage of life. My advice always is, and each of my daughters, this is what I say to them, sleep when the baby sleeps. If your night is broken, then fill in with sleep the next day, if you possibly can. And if you can't do it the next day, then over the weekend, cut back, quit some of those activities, and make up for the sleep. You can, the concept of sleep debt was also introduced by this commission, and namely, that sleep is like a bank account. You make deposits and you make withdrawals. And it's when you're overdrawn that you're in trouble. And you have a bad week and the kids are sick and you're up all night, you're overdrawn. Now at the earliest opportunity, make a deposit back and try to catch up with the sleep that you've lost. It's a very helpful concept, that. Okay, one right at the back and one over there, and then we'll call it quits. Yes. Yeah, shift work has got to be about the most stressfully damaging thing I know. Unless you follow certain important principles. The most important principle about shift work is that you're sleeping when everybody else is awake. But the most important problem is you're sleeping when the sun is out. So you have to somehow produce total darkness. And most curtains are not dark enough for melatonin to be adequately produced to get proper sleep. So the first thing you have to do, you've got to darken. Get those eye shades if necessary. The other thing is get earplugs. Sleep with earplugs. Shut out the sound. I sleep every night with earplugs. Shut out the sound. Then nothing can wake me. The depth of my sleep is far more satisfying. And my wife is the one who taught me how to do that. The other thing with shift work is that wherever possible, try to shift the cycle only a few hours at a time. The worst time is to go like an 8 or 12 hour shift change, because that's like perpetual jet lag is what it is. But if you can shift it 2 hours and 2 hours and 2 hours, that is preferred. But I concede that shift work is about the most damaging, and you've got to find a way around that. And particularly produce a darkened environment for your sleep. Because if you don't, you will not get the proper sleep that you need. One over there. That was your question. There was another one over there, and then Keith, back to you. What happens? Sleeping habits. Oh, tablets. Yes, I should have mentioned that. Let me tell you my opinion. The average sleeping pill does not produce sleep. It's a form of anesthesia. Now, the one and only time I had an operation, surgery, I didn't count the 2 hours as sleep. You know, it's anesthetic is what it is, and not sleep. Sleeping pills you'll pass out, but it's not sleep. Often it interferes with the dream, sleep, and so on. So they are devastating. Wherever possible, avoid them. Avoid them. Because I'm talking about sleeping preparations, because they are sedatives, and there are in serious sleep disorders, there are some other things you can do. The one thing you have to check out is make sure you don't suffer from sleep apnea, which is you stop breathing and then you wake up with a start and your sleep is disturbed. And there are sleep clinics, and Australia is well ahead in this field, and there are lots of sleep clinics that can diagnose sleep apnea. The second thing I would say is that there are other medications you can take for sleep that do not that facilitate sleep but don't disturb the sleep process. And one of them is a tricyclic antidepressant. And we prescribe it a lot. Not for the antidepressant effects, but for the sedating effects. Elavil, what's the equivalent of Elavil here? Amitriptyline. I think it's amitriptyline. Well, for example, it's very sedating. Now, that's a problem when people take it for depression, because you've got to take it last thing at night. But I've used it very successfully with patients who have serious sleep disorders, and it facilitates a good normal sleep. And once the sleep, then you have to get back to the habits. Once you break the cycle, you can get back into habits. And those preparations are much better than a sleeping pill that should be used only in extreme emergencies, because once your natural sleep patterns have been broken, it's really difficult to get back on track again.